Yeah, I think my paper does slot into slot beneath what Richard has just said. I mean, I did appreciate very much the sort of pessimism and skepticism of those claims, because I think this is a very much a paper with similar sort of anti-utopian purposes. It's also a paper that's, I think, more a think paper than a research paper. But I think, you know, as I sort of got on and as a scholar, I think that thinking things through in this way is actually very important. And I want to, in fact, get this right in terms of thinking through this issue before I do flesh it out into a research paper, because, of course, I may have misconceived it. You're wondering what the new technology does. It sometimes screws your formatting up. There. Okay, so this is a paper about what I think are misfires or mistaken claims about who's at fault, who's to blame for this global financial crisis and what should be done about them. These institutions, which I've studied for a very long time, have become a focus in the last 3 years. I mean, this has been great for me. I get contacted by people all the time and so on. It's very hard to penetrate the agencies now because it's sort of circling the wagons time, I think, for them. Anyway, it's nice to pick a research topic and find that it becomes increasingly important. I mean, I guess that's just good luck. I mean, I'd like to claim it was something more, but I'll put it down to good luck. Now, this terrible accusation made about these institutions, of course, that no doubt you've come across in the press yourself, is that there's some terrible conflict of interest in their operations and their business model, created by how they are remunerated. Now, I'm going to argue that this is mistaken, and in fact, it really clouds the issue and gets us away from what are the more important problems with these institutions. I mean, I think I'm a bit... I mean, Richard is somebody who spends a lot of his time thinking about institutions, but seems to me to be very sceptical about their potential efficacy, and I think I'm much the same. I don't really share the potential, the sort of neoliberal institutional assumption that one can perfect them. Now, I'm not going to do all of these things, but I'm going to talk a little bit about the context and what I think is a more substantial concern than the supposed conflict of interest. But let me say a little bit about the origins of these institutions. I mean, I guess the classic economist line about rating agencies is that they solve an information problem in markets. They provide data, they provide judgments that would not otherwise be there. And of course, this very much emerges in the specific context of the US after the Civil War. Now, I won't do this here, but in my published work, I sort of chart all the growth of this and how financial innovation and indeed crisis, I think, spurs the greater reach of the rating agencies. I think that's kind of fascinating, and I think, frankly, that that's exactly what's going on now. Despite our concerns about their performance, what we're actually seeing is a greater, in my view, a greater sphere for their operations in the future. In fact, you want any evidence of that, just look at how the TARP was organised. The rating agencies are at the very centre of that programme. So I would just mention that there is a sort of debate that goes on, which I, again, have sort of explored at some length, between an economistic view of the agencies as solving information problems, as I mentioned earlier, and a kind of constructivist view that they represent a brand, they represent a way of understanding things. I guess a behavioral economist would see it as a way of short-circuiting a lot of costs by simply referring to the rating agency's judgments. But I'm not going to go into that at any great length. I just wanted to get a couple of points out there. I mean, it's intriguing. I mean, as I guess we've seen the growth of so-called neoliberalism, we've seen the increasing attractiveness of this model across the world. I call this the new global finance. I'm writing a book with an ex-PhD student on what I call the problem with banks. And the problem with banks is that they're increasingly trying to get into the market that the rating agencies have made their own, the capital markets. You know, we think of banks as lending money. You go to a bank, they lend you money, they take your deposits and so on. But in fact, banks don't really make much money out of that. What they make their money out of today is out of selling you services. This is the process of disintermediation. The individual increasingly, but certainly the corporation, the municipality and so on, borrows money in the deep capital markets. Much more efficient, much cheaper. French municipalities do it. Russian municipalities do it, incredibly. Now, I think this process is going to accelerate. And I guess my best evidence for this is, one, of course, the deterioration in bank balance sheets, you know, which we can see. But secondly, the historical account, which I haven't mentioned here, which is the Asia crisis. You know, what did the Asia crisis do? Well, the rating agencies got seriously criticized for performance over that, but it was the best thing that ever happened to them in terms of expanding their role in a whole new world of Asia. And they're brilliantly set up there because, of course, what became very unattractive in Asia with the Asia crisis was a lot of kleptomaniac institutions that we call banks. So this process, you know, crisis has actually been a stimulus to the role of these institutions, and I think it will, again, despite the expressions of concern about these institutions that we hear now. Now, let me just skip ahead here. Going back to what Richard was saying earlier about Anne-Marie Slaughter and co., and it seems to me that the scrutiny that we see of the rating agencies does certainly suggest that this notion that they're autonomous, non-state institutions, that they can do what they want, that which is really the vision that I have to say I started this research with, because I wanted them to really destroy state power. That was the idea. And I think with time, with these events, and certainly with this most recent event, that is not a sustainable position. I mean, the state has engaged in, as I say, a serious disciplining of these agencies. Right? They've come as close as they've ever been to complete elimination. Okay, so this brings me to this issue of conflict of interest. And this is really the guts of the paper, and it's certainly what I would like to get some feedback about, if I could, from you. As we know, the business model of the agencies became a scandal, very much, I think that's the right term, in the second half of 2007. Now, I should put a little background. I mean, the basic problem, of course, is that they secure their revenue from those they rate. So if you issue bonds or securities, you have to pay the institutions, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, a fee for that. And that fee will vary by the complexity of the instrument, but also by the amount of money involved, by the size of the financing. And of course, the accusation is, this is a terrible scandal. How could we have ever let this happen? These institutions clearly have very strong incentives to inflate ratings. Now, a little bit of background on this. I mean, I think one of the sort of missing links in economistic writing about this, but also writing by lawyers like Frank Partnoy in California, is that they don't really feed the history in. And if you feed a little bit of the history in, I think that you can get a better sense of why all this happened. And the basic problem was we had very, very expansive capital markets in the 1960s, of course, backing up MNC growth around the world, and the classic rating model of revenue, which at that time was selling subscriptions, no longer worked, because there's a public goods problem with rating agencies, because when they issue something in terms of a rating up or down, of course it becomes news, and as soon as it hits the press, everybody knows about it, and of course it's impossible to get somebody to pay. So you know, at the same time as they had more and more work to do, people in the 1960s, they also had a stagnant or indeed declining revenue base. So they went to Congress at the end of the 60s and in various hearings. Congressional hearings are fascinating things, as we know, and made their case for moving to an issuer-pays model, which is the model we still have to this day. And this supposedly is the great scandal. Now, my point about this is that conflicts of interest, of course, are endemic in modern society. I mean, here at Boston University, beautiful place, very eminent institution, it charges fees to students, as does Warwick in its graduate programs and to a small extent in its undergraduate programs. Now, inevitably, there is a conflict of interest issue with that. Because if you are charging people and also marking or grading people, implicitly, there is a problem with that. And of course, this institution, like every other institution in the United States and around the world, has developed a whole panoply of means to cope with that conflict of interest, right, to manage that conflict of interest. And I would contend that that is exactly the situation with the rating agencies, that they too have those sorts of things. For example, that employees may not invest in the issues that they rate, or the institutions that they rate. And I would make the point that no evidence has been offered that management is ineffective in this means, that the management of this conflict of interest is ineffective. I mean, I don't know if you followed Henry Waxman's pronouncements about the rating agencies. He had a hearing about 18 months ago, I think, one of 12 congressional hearings about the rating agencies since 2005. And Waxman introduced all sorts of evidence that he'd actually obtained by getting, I think, federal marshals to go into the rating agencies and literally grab information. It was fascinating to me. And of course, selectively cited it in his little introduction to the congressional to the hearing. What he'd missed out on were moments like when the president of Moody's Investors Service said to the SEC in a letter, "Please tell us how to regulate us." Sorry, I've got that wrong the wrong way. When the SEC said to the president of Moody's, "Please tell us how you should be regulated, because we don't know." Right? So, I mean, Waxman left out all the kind of fascinating stuff that he, and he just cited the kind of, if it looks like a cow, we'll rate it, sort of stuff that you may have come across in the media. But in fact, there are genuine intellectual challenges to most financial analysis, most analysis of any description, and there are genuine issues of how to manage information and how to manage your employees and so on. And these institutions engage in those, as do others, and I think, generally speaking, very successfully. Now, my view is that there is a much more substantial concern than this. And basically, my framework for this is the work of John Searle. I've become very enamored of the work of John Searle in the last few years, very clear, thoughtful, and I think very analytical philosopher. And he really draws this distinction between regulative rules and constitutive rules. And I guess the classic example that he uses is the game of chess versus driving. You can drive your car down the road, indeed I do this in Britain every day, without necessarily knowing the rules, right? As long as I drive on the right side of the road and avoid hitting people, which I've managed to do for the last 12 years, I can get away with it. But I actually don't know what quite a lot of the signs mean. In fact, in Britain, working out how fast you're supposed to be driving on the road is a bit of an art. I went to a driver education session because I've been taught going through a speed camera in a village. I was coming down a hill and they just put it there. It was a speed track. It was a speed track. Anyway, I went 35 miles an hour through a 30 zone and went to the session. And it does turn out that actually working out how fast you should be going on a lot of rural roads in Britain is a matter of sort of divining things from the ether. It's the signage is not transparent. Okay, so that's fine. So it's not just me, it's everybody else. But my point is, I can do it, I can get away with it, and I've not had any
injury or anything else. You can't do that with a game of chess, right? Chess only exists because of the rules. And this is the distinction that I think is key to this. The public panic, political and sort of mass public, has focused on the notion that the regulative rules have let us down. But the real problems, in my view, are the chess game problems, you know. I mean, the real problems are that the rules of the game became disconnected at some point. And this is, I think this is all very much charted by the Bank of England in its financial stability reports. Really, all this happened in the summer of 2007. That's when the financial crisis really occurs in this world. It doesn't occur in 2008. That's just the kind of, that's just the follow-on. That's really just the sequel. What really happens is that counterparties become completely distrustful of each other. Essentially, the trust, the confidence, the ability to engage with each other, which is obviously essential in any market interaction, is lost. The constitutive rules have become unclear. Right? So that, to me, is really the great issue with the financial crisis. But it's also the issue with the rating agency specifically. Let me try to explain why. Structured finance is premised on very, very arcane legal rights, right? You know, you've got a stream of revenues flowing from mortgage payments, they flow into a trust, and then you have a series of tranches from that trust paying out to the bondholders, from AAA down to C. And these bondholders have different rights to be paid, right? And the great wonder of structured finance is that you can have a whole lot of East Los Angeles mortgages that pay in, and you can have AAA bonds at the other end, because the rating is not of the mortgages per se, it is of the right to get a revenue first. So the AAA people, they get their revenues first, and the C get whatever's left at the end, and they may get nothing. So the point of this is that it's enormously complex legally. And what actually happens, I think, in this process isn't that there's payments. There isn't this regulatory rules, conflict of interest, the rating agencies are taking backhanders and inflating the grades and all those sort of things. No, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that rating agencies move from being the judge, from being the professor grading the paper, to we, as academics, we give advice to students on how to write their papers, how to improve their papers. And the rating agencies, in a sense, do this as well. But unfortunately, at some point in this process, they ceased to be academics advising students, if you will, and they became editors of the papers themselves. They became the people who actually created the financial instruments. Right? They actually started to set up criteria for these financial instruments themselves. And that, I think, is where the constitutive crisis occurs specifically in the context of these institutions, because they move from the role of judge to the role of advisor, to indeed to the role of deal maker. I mean, that's probably the distinction, isn't it? It's judge, from judge, independent judge, to deal maker. My brother's a lawyer, he's a deal maker. And in no way, shape or form is he an independent party in that equation. And I think that's the constitutive problem. And that, to me, is the substantial concern. Now, I suspect that when you look at that sort of distinction between regulative and constitutive, that gives you a much more kind of rancor-edged device with which to understand this crisis, at least I hope it does, than what we've had so far. So I guess, how would I finish? I mean, I think that the problem with this crisis is that it was constitutive and not regulative. Because most people are socialized into thinking in regulative terms, basically their reaction, like Lloyd Blankfein, when asked about the origins of the crisis, was to go, "Dunno." I mean, that's literally his reaction in the congressional hearing, because he didn't know, because he doesn't think in terms of trust. He doesn't think in terms of the constitutive rules that actually make market transactions possible. He thinks of those things as natural and inevitable, and he thinks merely of the status of applying regulative rule interventions. And what I'm suggesting to you is that that is an inadequate understanding, Mr. Goldman Sachs, of financial markets. And it suggests to me further that states really don't get it. They haven't learned this lesson. I think it was yesterday or the day before I heard Lord Turner, the head of the Financial Services Authority in London, suggesting that the whole problem with the financial crisis was regulation and the failures of regulation, whereas, as I suggest here, that is not the case. Okay, I was going to say some more about how the rating agencies could reconstruct their role and everything, but I think I'll leave it at that. Basically, constitutive crisis, not a regulative crisis. The state really hasn't learned its lesson because these are immensely counterintuitive ways to think about how how markets work and the role of institutions in markets, and therefore we have to just hope that the same set of circumstances that produced this crisis does not recur. But certainly I don't see any, a bit like Richard's skepticism earlier, I don't see any sort of great basis for confidence that institutions will be able to prevent us from getting there.